From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we reflect on life in Iran during the Iran-Iraq War and the Iranian Revolution with Azar Nafisi. She taught English at the University of Tehran before being expelled for refusing to wear the veil. She then led a book group for women in her home, reading the classics of Western literature. Her new memoir is Reading Lolita in Tehran. And film critic John Powers reviews The Good Thief, the new crime caper by Irish director Neil Jordan. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. U.S. troops are conducting a security sweep of the Baghdad airport in search of Iraqi fighters. Signaling control of the key facility in the Iraqi capital, U.S. forces have removed Saddam Hussein's name from the airport. A high-ranking Iraqi official warns U.S.-led forces are in for a surprising attack. From Baghdad, NPR's Anne Garrels has details.
Mohammad Saeed Sahaf, the information minister, warned of a non-conventional action tonight against the U.S.-led forces at the Baghdad airport. The words non-conventional sent a ripple through the press corps. Was this an admission the Iraqis would use chemical weapons? No, he said. Iraqis might use martyrdom or guerrilla action. He added, "We will do something which I believe is very beautiful, very new, and creative."
NPR's Anne Garrels in Baghdad. U.S.-led forces appear to have secured a major artery leading into the Iraqi capital. Jeffrey Moen of the Los Angeles Times is embedded with the Army's 3rd Infantry Division south of the Iraqi capital.
Clearly, their prime mission is to control Highway 1, which is a north-south artery leading into Baghdad, and they're doing a pretty good job of that. I'm actually sitting here in the middle of a four-lane highway having dinner. So there's clearly no traffic on this highway, nothing anywhere near here.
Jeffrey Moen of the Los Angeles Times. Baghdad's residents are leaving in droves. Despite Saddam's call to stand up and fight, people are packing their vehicles with basic necessities and leaving town. They're trying to escape through the two exit routes remaining in the northern and eastern sections of the city. President Bush will travel to Belfast, Northern Ireland next week to meet with British Prime Minister Tony Blair. The war in Iraq will top the agenda. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
This will be the third summit meeting between the president and the prime minister in just over 3 weeks. The first was in the Portuguese Azores just prior to the start of the war. Then last week, Blair came to the U.S. for a war summit at Camp David. Now President Bush will go to Northern Ireland for a meeting that could take place as U.S. and British troops fight Iraqi forces within the city limits of Baghdad. White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer says the talks will cover the status of the war, but will also look ahead.
They will talk about the humanitarian relief efforts. They'll talk about reconstruction. I think they'll talk about the role of the United Nations. They will also talk about the peace process in Northern Ireland. And I think the subject of the Middle East could come up as well.
The president will fly to Belfast on Monday, returning to the U.S. the following day. Don Gagne, NPR News, The White House.
On Wall Street, the Dow closed up 37 points to 8277 in heavy volume of more than 1.2 billion shares. The Nasdaq closed down 13 points. This is NPR. An American journalist has been killed in Iraq. The Atlantic Monthly says Michael Kelly, its editor-at-large, died yesterday in a Humvee accident along with an American soldier. NPR's Corey Flintoff reports.
Michael Kelly was embedded with the U.S. Army's 3rd Infantry Division. Details of the accident aren't clear, but a spokeswoman in Kuwait said a reporter and a soldier were killed when their Humvee went into a canal near Baghdad. Kelly was known as a conservative columnist for the Washington Post and was credited for bringing new vigor into the Atlantic Monthly. The magazine's literary editor, Ben Schwartz, says Kelly was an extremely thoughtful man.
But also a man of action and a man who always wanted to be in the fray, whether it was a savage debate in this country or a war overseas.
Michael Kelly was 46. He's survived by his wife and two young sons. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Some Canadians are showing their support for the U.S.-led campaign in Iraq. A group called Friends of America has been rallying in Toronto in support of the war against Iraq. Members also criticize Canada for not sending its own troops to help. Cuban authorities say they've arrested the group of men who hijacked a passenger ferry earlier this week, hoping to get to the United States. The government says it rescued nearly 50 hostages on board without having to use deadly force. On Tuesday, a Cuban airline jet was also hijacked. It landed in Florida, and the hijacker was arrested. No further details on the hijacker have been provided. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Ewing Marion Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, encouraging entrepreneurship across America, emkf.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross. Azar Nafisi was a literature professor in Tehran from 1979 to 1995. The Western authors she loved and taught in her classroom were condemned by some students for being anti-Islamic and colonialistic. Nafisi was criticized for the books she taught and for not veiling herself properly. After resigning from the university in 1995, she invited seven of her best women students to come to her home every Thursday morning to discuss literature. Books like Pride and Prejudice, The Great Gatsby, Madame Bovary, and Lolita. Her new memoir, Reading Lolita in Tehran, is a reflection on how these books gave a different color to life in Iran and how this group of women redefined the novels they read. Nafisi's memoir also tells the story of her life in Tehran and how it was changed by the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Nafisi left Iran in 1997 and is a professor at Johns Hopkins University. She's now living through her second war with Saddam Hussein. She was in Tehran throughout the Iran-Iraq War, which lasted from 1980 to 1988. Terry spoke with Azar Nafisi and asked her to open with a passage from her book about the Iran-Iraq War.
The war with Iraq began September 1980 and did not end until late July 1988. Everything that happened to us during those 8 years of war and the direction our lives took afterward was in some way shaped by this conflict. It was not the worst war in the world, although it left over 1 million dead and injured. At first, the war seemed to pull the divided country together. We were all Iranian and the enemy had attacked our homeland. But even in this, many were not allowed to participate fully. From the regime's point of view, the enemy had attacked not just Iran, it had attacked the Islamic Republic, and it had attacked Islam. The polarization created by the regime confused every aspect of life. Not only were the forces of God fighting an emissary of Satan, Iraq's Saddam Hussein, but they were also fighting agents of Satan inside the country. At all times, from the very beginning of the revolution and all through the war and after, the Islamic regime never forgot its holy battle against its internal enemies. All forms of criticism were now considered Iraqi-inspired and dangerous to national security. Those groups and individuals without a sense of loyalty to the regime's brand of Islam were excluded from the war effort. They could be killed or sent to the front, but they could not voice their social or political preferences. There were only two forces in the world, the army of God and that of Satan.
That's Azar Nafisi reading from her new memoir, Reading Lolita in Tehran. You know, you lived through the Iran-Iraq War while you were living in Tehran, and now you're living in the United States, living through America's war with Iraq. Can you just compare a little bit how the United States is describing Saddam Hussein and talking about Iraq with how the Iranian government did?
I find it very ironic that I left Iran to leave behind the war and the terror, and I came to the United States, and not only the war, but the war with Iraq followed me here. So there should be some lesson in there somewhere, I'm sure. I'm not talking about whether the current war is good or bad, but you asked me whether, you know, what are the differences between the position that the government here is taking and the position that the government in Iran was taking. Well, I think that we always tend to turn our enemy into Satan anyway. During any war, there are polarizations, and this polarization exists in the United States today. The difference is that over here, people can talk openly about the war. And if they don't agree with it, they can even protest in the streets, and they can voice their protests through the media or other forms. And over there, we not only could not voice our protests, we could not even voice our grief. And we ourselves were suspected, if we strayed from the line, as being, you know, pro-Iraqi or pro-Saddam. And that is a very, very lonely position, to not being able to voice your feelings and emotion during such time.
What do you mean you couldn't even express your grief? I mean, there were so many people killed. There must have been a lot of grief in Iran to express.
Well, there was a lot of grief, and there is, in another part of my book, I explain that, for example, many times when a bomb would hit a place, there were these motorcyclists who would be dressed all in black, who would immediately, before the ambulances or the police would arrive, they would arrive on the scene of destruction, and they would start shouting slogans, death to Saddam, death to U.S. imperialism. And they would prevent people who had survived from publicly crying or, you know, expressing their grief over those who had been killed. Because at all times, they wanted to say that the Iranian people not only accept this war, but are ready to, you know, give their lives and the lives of their children for this war and for this revolution. The same is true with when they killed the opponents of the regime. Most of the times, those who were killed, their families were not allowed to have public mourning, to mourn their children or their relatives and friends.
Did you lose a lot of friends or family in the war with Iraq?
I think that I was one of the more luckier ones. I lost some distant relatives, and I lost students during the war, but I did not lose people who were very close to me. I'm very thankful for that. But when I say that, it's always with a sense of guilt, because whenever a bomb hit some part of Tehran, whenever somebody else died, we would have to be happy that it wasn't us or people who belonged to us. And it creates such a sense of guilt in you. So survival even becomes guilty.
Right, because part of you is thinking, thank God it was them and not my husband.
Yeah. And, you know, immediately, no matter what time it was, and a lot of times they struck, you know, at 4 in the morning in, after midnight, you know. But every time the missile struck or a bomb struck, we would start calling one another, you know, to make sure that people who were close to us were alive and well. And every time we heard their voice, we would say, thank God. And immediately afterwards, I would think, oh, my God, I'm saying thank God while somebody else is right now grieving the death of somebody close to them. And this is the contradiction that you feel. And I also felt very close to the Iraqi people.
Why? Why did you feel close to them?
Well, you know, it started a little later. I mean, at first, the first 1 or 2 years of war, you know, we spent being confused about what had happened to us. But I remember at a certain point, I realized that every time there were victory marches on the radio saying that the regime has destroyed one more nest of spies or vermin in Iraq, it means that some Iraqis, not the regime, not Saddam's regime, but Iraqis just like us have been murdered. And that would mean that pretty soon Saddam would attack us. Because usually, you know, they would sort of respond to one another's attacks, and they had no compunction in bombing and killing the civilians.
In the 1980s, when you were living in Tehran, during the Iran-Iraq war, You were opposed to your own government, to the government of the Ayatollah, the fundamentalist government in Iran. And you were obviously being attacked by Iran's enemy, Iraq. So in that sense, you had no place to turn. I mean, your government, your own country's government wasn't your friend. And, of course, the Saddam Hussein government wasn't your friend either. Where do you turn in a situation like that? You've got no place to go.
Yeah, that's exactly it. A lot of people felt the same way I did. And, of course, the feelings are so contradictory because nobody likes their country to be invaded or bombed. So naturally, you turn to your own government to protect your country, not just you, but the land you were born in and you live in. So first of all, there was that contradiction. And the second thing, one thing that happened during that time was that people got so close to one another. You would be walking down the streets and suddenly there would be the sirens and you know that a bomb would fall. So all of a sudden, the stranger next to you, another passerby, would become like your brother or your sister because you might be dying together the next moment. I developed so many lasting friendships during the war. Sometimes people would come to my house or I would go to a friend's house, and about 20 of us would just stay the night because, we would be afraid that if we leave, there would be bombing or the missiles would fall on us. So that grief and that loneliness made me feel much closer to my people than I have ever felt in my life.
During the Iran-Iraq war, was there any more or less attention paid to the enemy within, so to speak, to people like you who were the dissidents within Iran?
Oh, definitely. Right before the war, there was a lot of unrest and a lot of dissatisfaction, which was being expressed publicly. And the war was a very good opportunity for the Iranian government to put down dissent in the name of the war. And in fact, in one part of my book, I talk about a slogan from Ayatollah Khomeini, who said, "This war is a great blessing for us." And one reason he said that, because he could now put down the opposition in the name of, there being Iraqi agents or Iraqi spies. Now, I wasn't a member of a political organization or an organized group or party. My opposition to the system was more existential than political. But I know of friends who belonged to political parties who, in fact, went to the front to fight and they were put in jail. And I know of two cases where later on they were killed. And these people were going to war. They wanted to help in the war effort. They were not there to voice their dissent. Nobody voiced dissent to the war, of course. And that was unquestionable.
Azar Nafisi speaking with Terry Gross. Nafisi's memoir is called Reading Lolita in Tehran. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest is literature professor Azar Nafisi. She moved to the U.S. from Iran in 1997. Her new memoir is called Reading Lolita in Tehran.
If you feel comfortable sharing it, I'd be very interested to hear your thoughts on the United States' war with Iraq.
I feel very ambiguous and ambivalent. I mean, this is the contradiction. I hate Saddam Hussein. I think he's one of the worst dictators in the whole wide world. And I know, as much as I can be certain of anything, that the majority of Iraqi people hate him and they want to be rid of him. I also know that when you live in a totalitarian society, it is very difficult for the people who feel helpless and hopeless to stage uprisings against their own regime, and international support is needed. how far U.S. would go in supporting genuine democracy in Iraq and helping in creation of a representative government remains to be seen. I think that both my own people and Iraqi people rightly remain suspicious of motives and intentions until they see those motives and intentions proved in reality, in actuality.
So you hate Saddam Hussein, but you're not confident that this war is the right way of dealing
with him. I have to see that this war goes in the right direction. I have my criticisms of what happened in Afghanistan, compromising with the Northern Alliance, for example, and not going behind the democratic forces there. And of course, to tell you the truth, one thing that concerns me more, I think September 11 taught us that if we want to prevent terror in the streets of New York and Washington, D.C., you have to support the democratic forces, those that are against terror in the streets of Kabul and Tehran. That calls for a long-term policy of genuinely supporting the democratic forces in those countries and not remaining indifferent to the fates of people who live in those countries. Many in here keep saying it's their culture, it's the Islamic culture, and we cannot impose our own culture on them. I think both democracy and terror are universal. And I don't think it's my people's culture to want to be stoned to death or for its women to desire female genital mutilation. Our culture is our great poets and thinkers and philosophers.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Azar Nafisi, and she's an Iranian professor of literature who left Iran and is now living in the United States, where she teaches literature at Johns Hopkins University. Her new memoir is called Reading Lolita in Tehran. Your book, Reading Lolita in Tehran, is about a reading group. It's a memoir of your life in some ways, but it's also more specifically about a reading group that you created for a small group of women students in 1995 after you resigned from your position as a professor of literature. Let's start with why you left the university. Why did you leave?
Well, you know, my academic life in Iran was sort of like guerrilla warfare. It was constantly attack and retreat because I got my degree in the United States in 1979. And I went to Iran after that, and I started teaching at the University of Tehran. At that time, women were still not forced to wear the veil, despite the efforts of Ayatollah Khomeini and many in the government. But when they made the veil mandatory in the universities and in workplaces, I and two of my colleagues in our faculty refused to wear it. So that was the first time I was sort of, I was expelled from the university. And then I stayed at home and just read and wrote for a long time until the atmosphere became more liberal, and I went back to teach at this time at a different university. And I taught from mid-80s until 1995. To tell you the truth, I became so tired of the war over the way I wore my veil, strands of my hair showing, my best students being penalized or expelled, not because of their academic records, but because they had talked to a boy in the halls. One of my girls was penalized because she was late for class and she ran up the stairs and she was forced to write a retraction saying, "I promise I would never run in the halls of university even when I'm late for class."
Is that unladylike to run? Is that the problem?
Yeah, because a girl running would attract attention to herself. Uh-huh. Another one was penalized for giggling. They mentioned in her file laughter of a giggling kind, you know, because a girl is not supposed to raise her voice, you know, in a way that would attract attention. And I felt that at some point I felt that this is not teaching anymore. So that is when I decided to resign. Of course, they didn't accept my resignation.
Why not?
Well, one friend later on told me that, you know, they want to have so much control over everything that they won't accept it if you resign. They are the ones who decide whether you should stay or leave, you know, not you.
That's almost funny.
And that is the main thing.
So you were able to resign successfully even though they didn't want you to resign?
Yes. What I did, I just stopped going. And they kept calling me and saying, come and negotiate, let's talk over this, you know. And I just refused. And finally, actually, it was just before I left for the U.S. that they finally agreed with my resignation.
So what was your purpose in starting this reading group?
Well, to tell you the truth, I always had this dream where I could have a class in which those who participated were completely and wholly committed to the works that we read and discussed about. And I felt that, of course, I couldn't have a mixed class because that would become dangerous. If they found out that, you know, we had girls and boys in the class, then the morality police could cause trouble for us. So I decided that I would have only my girl students participate in this class. And as it turned out, because it was all women and because we sort of opened up to one another, it became very successful. I don't think it would have been as successful if we had the male students in there as well.
Because it was all women, you were able to take your veils off while you were discussing literature?
Yes. You know, in my book, I talk about these two photographs that we took with my students on the last day I was in Tehran. And in one photograph, we're dressed in our robes and scarves the way we are in public. And in the other one, we are dressed the way we were, you know, when we participated in these classes. And two of my students were devout practicing Muslims, and they wore their scarves, whether they were inside my home or not. But the amazing thing was that how in the second photograph, all of a sudden everybody had developed an outline, a personality, while in that other photograph, you could almost not distinguish one from the other. And I felt that that was very symbolic of what was done to us.
Azar Nafisi. Her memoir is called Reading Lolita in Tehran. We'll continue Terry's interview with Nafisi in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Anchor Books, paperback publishers of the mystery The Number One Ladies Detective Agency by Alexandra McCall Smith. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, putting the book The Great Gatsby on trial in the classroom. We continue our conversation with Azar Nafisi, who taught English at the University of Tehran. She has a new memoir. Also, John Powers reviews The Good Thief, the new film by director Neil Jordan. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross. Let's continue Terry's interview with Azar Nafisi, who taught literature in Tehran for 16 years. Nafisi left Iran in 1997 and is now a professor at Johns Hopkins University. When we left off, Nafisi was talking about how she resigned from Tehran University in 1995 and started a reading group with seven of her best women students at her home every Thursday morning. Nafisi's new memoir is titled Reading Lolita in Tehran.
Now, you say of all the books that you read, that Lolita was the book that most resonated with your lives in Iran. That comes as a surprise. What resonated
yes,
about
know.
Lolita?
I know. Many people over here are surprised. Well, the title of the book is Reading Lolita in Tehran, and I wanted to talk about how Lolita brought out what Tehran was all about and vice versa. Lolita, on the surface, is about this 38-year-old man, Humbert Humbert, who rapes and molests and imprisons this 12-year-old child, Lolita. But if you remember from the very first page, Humbert Humbert says that Lolita reminded him of his childhood love, Annabel Lee. And in fact, Lolita is about confiscation of another human being's life and on imposing your own dream of the past on that individual's life. And Humbert destroys Lolita. And in the end, he destroys himself. But Lolita, and you know, my students really caught this, despite the fact, I mean, we read all of these books in English, and despite the difficulty of language, there was something in the book that resonated with them. The idea that you can't confiscate another person's life. People should have a choice. People should have a choice to live the way they want to live. And I think Lolita, like every great book, is about choice. And so it became a symbol for me of what my life had become over there.
Now, if the morality police knew that you were teaching Lolita, would you have been arrested?
I don't know. There is another thing about this regime which reminds me of Nabokov's novels, actually his Invitation to a Beheading. This sort of a regime is very arbitrary. One thing that really made us exhausted and made us feel helpless was not just the fear of, you know, wearing our clothes properly or, you know, walking down the streets in the right manner, but the fact that we never knew whether they will arrest us or not. Sometimes you could be, you know, dressed improperly and they would let you go. At another time, they would arrest women who were dressed in chadors, you know, which is even more strict than wearing the veil and robes that we were required to wear. I think it's the unexpectedness and the arbitrariness of such a regime that makes it successful, because you never know. There is never enough. You cannot do enough to convince them to leave you alone.
Before you left the university and started this reading group, another great American book that you taught, but this one was at the university, was The Great Gatsby. What were the connections that you made between The Great Gatsby and life in Iran?
You know, as I was writing the book, I discovered how ironic it was that as I was teaching my students about the American dream, just downstairs, in the yard of the University of Tehran, they were shouting down with U.S. imperialism, you know. But I wanted my students to get to know the culture that was now reduced into the title of Great Satan. I wanted them to get to know that other aspect of the culture, which was now being denied them. And while the majority of my students appreciated it, some of my ideological students, both on the left and especially the Islamists, felt that this was a decadent book and that it showed how decadent American society is, and they wanted it banned. So actually I put the book on trial.
What was the trial?
Well, the fact was that one of these guys who was one of the most active leaders of the Islamic student associations came to me objecting against Gatsby and calling Fitzgerald all sorts of names for being decadent and loving imperialism. So I thought that the best way for us to deal with this, I wasn't about to take the book out of the class because he was talking this way, but I wanted the class to share in this experience. I wanted them to not just reject or accept something, but I wanted them to understand that the debate around the book was more important than taking a position for or against it. So I suggested that we'll put the book on trial, and I assigned him to be the prosecutor. And the students assigned me to be the book itself. And one of my best students, who was just a wonderful, beautiful girl, she was the defense attorney for Gatsby. And so we brought out different aspects of the book, and we at least reached the conclusion that the book was not only not immoral, but it was in fact moral, and it was a condemnation of those rich and wealthy people they said Fitzgerald imitated or desired to be.
When you were teaching very controversial books in Iran, books that wouldn't be controversial here but were there, like The Great Gatsby, Lolita, Wuthering Heights, was it difficult to actually get the books?
Yeah, many of them were either banned or they were not in the bookstores. So a lot of times what would happen is that you try to find one copy and then have it Xeroxed. And sometimes it was really amazing. I mean, you know, you would get one copy of Tom Jones and try and Xerox 800 pages, you know. But that also shows how amazingly eager the students were to read these books and to discuss them. So they would pay for that.
Were you ever denounced by your students?
I was opposed by some of my students especially when I was teaching Henry James. It's so funny. Nobody would believe it, but Henry James was one of the most controversial writers that I taught in Iran. And there was this Islamist student of mine who every time I taught Daisy, you know, something about Daisy Miller, he would get up and start objecting and saying that Daisy Miller is bad and she should be dead. And, you know, James is bad, you know, in a very simplistic term.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And I think that one thing that really bothered them about James was the fact that James brings ambiguity into his characters, brings doubt. And that is why he becomes so subversive, because this sort of mentality doesn't want to have any doubt.
You're not allowed to have any doubt. There is
no
ambiguity.
You're not allowed to have any doubt. But I have been opposed by or criticized by many. But the amazing thing for me is that I seldom was really denounced. I wasn't denounced by my students, no. I was opposed, especially this guy. His image is so alive in my mind right now, the way he stood up and started denouncing James.
Azar Nafisi speaking with Terry Gross. Nafisi's memoir about the book group she started with some of her female students is called Reading Lolita in Tehran. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest is literature professor Azar Nafisi. Her new memoir is called Reading Lolita in Tehran.
Iran is part of what President Bush has described as the axis of evil. It's Iran, North Korea, and Iraq. How do you feel about Iran being on that, quote, axis of evil?
Well, I think that there needs to be a differentiation always between the governments of these countries and the people of these countries. Otherwise, a lot of misunderstandings come about. Neither the people of Iran, North Korea, nor Iraq can be part of the axis of evil. They are part of the axis that need to be liberated from evil. And by that, I don't mean that we constantly need forces from outside to liberate us, but we definitely need the support of forces from outside in this liberation. So I think that we need to constantly differentiate between the Iranian people and the Iranian government.
Since Iran is considered to be on the axis of evil by the Bush administration, and since Iran is now on the verge of getting nuclear weapons, do you think Iran might be next? Do you think Iran might be attacked by the United States?
Well, I hope not. And I tell you one thing about Iran, and it's not just because I'm Iranian. I think that Iran has a lot of lessons for the other countries in the region to learn. For the past few years, you have seen the rise of a genuine movement for democracy in Iran. People have been coming into the streets, writing articles and essays, asking for political freedom, talking about the separation of state from religion. And this is not just seculars. This is, in fact, former Islamic revolutionaries and many progressive clerics. So I don't think that the United States should or need to attack Iran. What the United States needs to do is to support the issues that Iranian people are right now fighting for. I think Iran can be a good model, a good example of how a people are fighting to change their political and social and cultural life through nonviolent methods. We don't want a regime change in Iran. We want a change of mind. We want a change from absolutism and despotism to democracy. And that is not doable through just a simple regime change.
Now, you say that one of the differences between your generation and the generation of your students is that your generation had a memory of life before the revolution, and your students didn't have any memory like that. They only knew life after the revolution. So what are some of the implications of that difference?
Yeah, that made them very bitter. That, in fact, made my own daughter, who's younger than my students, she's now 19, also very bitter. Because I remember once we had this discussion about the past, and I was telling them about my own student experiences in the U.S., and I was telling them about going to concerts I used to wear long hippie dresses during that period. And I was telling them about the way I dressed, the movies we went to. And there was such bitterness in the air. And they told us, you have at least memories that you resurrect and you are happy to live with. But for us, any memory that we have, we want to forget. And one of them said, you know, what can I tell others about when I was 19, that I had been twice taken to jail and once flogged 26 times because I didn't wear my veil properly. So it made them very, very bitter. But I think that it made them much more resilient than my generation as well. My generation really didn't know what individual freedoms meant. When I was shouting against the Shah here in the U.S., I was only thinking of political freedoms. Never did I realize how political freedoms depend upon our defense of our individual freedoms. Without them, they mean nothing.
Now, your father was political. Your father was the mayor of Tehran. He was, I think,
yes,
the youngest mayor,
yes,
in the history of the city. And then I think he was elected in 1961, is that right?
Yes, yes. And
and then a couple of years later, he was arrested, and he was in jail for about 6 years.
He was arrested, I think, in 1963, and, he remained in jail for 4 years.
4 years.
4 years,
okay.
Yeah.
What was he imprisoned for, and what kind of impact did it have on you as a girl to know that your father was in prison for political reasons?
It just changed my whole worldview. Until then, I had never thought about it. I had never thought about politics. I had never thought about what kind of government we had or did not have in Iran. It was an amazing shock. And at first, there was such sense of loneliness now that I had to stand in front of the place where he was jailed for an hour or two before I was admitted, you know. But they kept him in jail, I think, for 5 years. And I'm sorry that I'm so bad with dates. And without the trial. And when they put him on trial and he defended himself, they absolved him of all charges but one, and that was insubordination. And I thought, okay, so insubordination is okay. You can question authority. You can subvert authority. You don't have to constantly conform to it. They were very hard years, and I never, ever felt secure after that. But I think they also taught me that insubordination is not something that is bad, but it is my right to practice it.
Here's something I'd really like to hear your thoughts on. I think for anybody who is a dissident in their culture, at some point you have to make the decision, are you going to stay or are you going to go?
Yeah.
And you were out of Iran as a college student because you studied here. Then you went back to Iran and you stayed there. You came back in the
late 18 years. Yeah,
okay. 18 years. But then you decided to leave. You decided you'd had it and it was time to leave the country. And you came to the United States. So what kept you in Iran for so long? And then why did you decide to... I mean, how do you make that decision that you're going to leave your country?
Well, it is very difficult. And at some point in my life, I thought that it is so ironic that all the time I stayed abroad and while I was in the U.S., I was dreaming of Iran. And once I went to Iran, I was dreaming of U.S. perhaps, or at least the kind of life I had here. And those 18 years that I stayed, it was partly out of the belief. I remember my husband always told me that just your being there, the way you are, is a sign of protest. And we need to be here. By here, of course, he meant in Iran. And he was right partially. But after that private class of mine, which was actually very successful, I felt that I was becoming very useless because I could only thrive through writing and teaching. I felt that both of them were taken away from me. When I wrote first book in Iran, which was about Nabokov, I knew that it most probably would not be reprinted. And the things that I wanted to write, I was not allowed to write. And my connections with these young people would have been cut because I wasn't teaching at the university and my whole life was limited to one room. And to tell you the truth, I really was dying to write and talk about my experiences, about the things that had been cooped up in me for so long. And I felt and I feel that the world, what Nabokov calls it, is a portable world. That home is geographical. I mean, I'll never forget my country of birth. As important is home. Home has become a set of values. And wherever I go, I will carry that.
Do you still have family in Iran? And what are you hearing from them about their concerns about the war with Iraq?
Yes. I'm sorry. That makes me... you touched a very sensitive spot. I have a lot of amazing friends and students in Iran, and my parents were in Iran, and my mother died last January, and I couldn't see her. So if you talk about regrets having left the place, there you have it.
Right. It's hard in the world now to be that far away from people who you love.
Yeah, it is It is hard. And, you know, both my parents wanted us to leave, especially for my children's sake. Mm-hmm. They wanted, you know, I always wanted, I'm not saying that I don't want my children to go back. That's their choice, wherever they want to live. But I wanted my son and daughter to have the same choices that I had when I was their age. I wanted them to see these two worlds that are so close and dear to me and actually to my husband as well, and then make their choice. I left when I was very young to study abroad, and I got a lot of good things from this world. And the warmth and the culture that Iran gave me complemented the one that I acquired here. You know, I always considered U.S. my other home. And I wanted my children to have that. And every time I called my mother, and the last time I called her, which was the last week before she died, she'd say, "It is so hard to be without you, but I'm so glad that you're not here." So at least it is not a consolation, but at least I know that being a mother, she wanted the best for us, you know.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us. I really appreciate
thank
it a lot.
Thank you. I appreciate this.
Azar Nafisi speaking with Terry Gross. Her memoir is called Reading Lolita in Tehran. Coming up, John Powers reviews the new film, The Good Thief. This is Fresh Air. Irish director Neil Jordan is most famous for his films Mona Lisa, The Crying Game, and Interview with the Vampire. His new movie, The Good Thief, is a crime caper based on the French film Bob le Flambeur and stars Nick Nolte along with an international cast. Film critic John Powers has a review.
There may be no more notorious eccentric in Hollywood than Nick Nolte, who's been known to show up in restaurants wearing his bathrobe. Still, that reputation took a quantum leap forward recently, when he was arrested for driving under the influence, and the police released a photo of the actor with gaga eyes, rubbery features, and hair flaring from his head like the fronds of an exhausted anemone. This became the most famous mugshot in history, when Steve Martin cheaply used it to win laughs from a billion people during the Oscars. Nolte, it seemed, had become a joke. Except for one thing. Nick Nolte is also one of the world's great screen actors. And he proves it again in The Good Thief, an enjoyable fable about a casino robbery that's a wonderful antidote to nonstop war coverage. The scene is the French Riviera, and Nolte is Bob Montagnier, a down-on-his-luck gambler and thief who's addicted to two things, heroin and his profound sense of personal honor. A glorious ruin, Bob desperately needs something to give him purpose, and he finds it in a 17-year-old Eastern European girl named Anne, wonderfully played by newcomer Nuzza Kukinyadze, who's been brought over to France to become a prostitute. Bob rescues her, and this noble act jumpstarts his life. Soon, he's going cold turkey in preparation for one final glorious heist, an elaborate plot to steal millions in art from a casino in Monte Carlo. It's a scheme that gets him involved with several troublemakers, including a shady art dealer played by Ralph Fiennes, and a detective named Roger. That's the terrific French actor Checky Cario. Roger has already sent Bob to prison 6 times, but in classic crime picture fashion, he's as much a friend as a nemesis. Here, Bob and Roger's game of cat and mouse finds them talking together in a church.
Have you heard the story of the good thief, Roger?
No, I'm not religious.
No, neither am I, but when my mother told it, I guess it stuck. The good thief beside Jesus on the cross. And Jesus said to him, "If I remember this right, tonight you will be with me in paradise." And the thought that there was a place in heaven for a thief always made me cry.
You want to make me cry now?
Oh, you gotta watch your cynicism, Roger. It's too easy in that job of yours.
I'd work on my attitude.
You sure?
The Good Thief is loosely adapted from Bob le Flambeur, the 1955 classic by Jean-Pierre Melville, the great French director who influenced everyone from Jean-Luc Godard to Quentin Tarantino. Melville was obsessed with huge questions of honor, destiny, and betrayal, and his original film was at once deadly serious and profoundly abstract. It unfolded with the algebraic precision of a story by Jorge Luis Borges. Neil Jordan's remake is also concerned with honor, but it's archer and less grave than the original. Jordan is far more interested in hanging out with an interesting collection of slippery characters than he is in the mechanics of the climactic heist. He turns Bob's story into a slouchy romp on the theme of what's authentic and what's fake. Bob owns a Picasso that may or may not be a forgery. He has a French mother who may or may not be French. And he's a criminal whose crookedness may possess more nobility than simply following the straight and narrow. What's undeniably real in all this is the movie's romanticism. This is Jordan's defining key signature. He made Mona Lisa and The Crying Game, after all. And he gives The Good Thief a dreamy old Hollywood sheen. As shot by Chris Menges, the south of France is swooningly glamorous, with sun-spanked daylight and mood indigo nights branded with the primary colors, especially the luscious blues of the Riviera underworld. This is the south of France as we all want to see it. But the romanticism runs even deeper than that. It extends to the conception of Bob, who's that most sentimental of figures, the noble criminal, who's like a lighthouse of salvation in the dark world he inhabits. Bob rescues the sexy young Anne, but even though she's willing, he doesn't take her to bed. He buys her elegant clothes instead. Finally, a man who knows what a girl really wants. And along the way, he enjoys a rebirth. When we first see Bob, he's a haggard junkie with the slitted eyes of a world-weary amphibian. By the final scene in Monte Carlo, he's strolling around in evening garb, capturing flashes of his youthful good looks. To be honest, all this makes The Good Thief the sheerest Hollywood fantasy. What props it up is Nolte, a great hulk of a man like Robert Mitchum or Marlon Brando, who acts with his whole body, wears his disillusion like a badge of honor, and has the primal force to embody a distinctively old-fashioned idea of masculinity, battered and strong and decent and doomed. A whiskey-voiced throwback, he's up to the mythic task that we want from a movie star. He can take a character like Bob, who's essentially an egghead's idealized portrait of a crook, and turn him into someone we can actually believe exists. At least until we walk out of the theater.
John Powers is film critic and media columnist for LA Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Schurach directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of The Only Girl in the Car, a memoir from debut author Kathy Dobie. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with biographer James Tobin about the World War II correspondent beloved by the public, the GIs, and generals alike, Ernie Pyle. Join us for the next Fresh Air.